It was bonfire night in Moston, a suburb just north of Manchester.
It's an increasingly policed area, and we're seeing a kind of increasing need for support in that area of particularly young black boys who are growing up there.
A 16-year-old called John Soyoye was walking down Kenyon Lane when he was attacked by a group wielding bats and machetes. He tried to flee, unsuccessfully, and was brutally stabbed as someone in the group filmed the attack. John later died from the injuries. 3 days later, John's friends set up a group chat to vent their grief and anger over his death.
It was created by one of the boys as a place to memorialise John and to talk about how they would remember him. But it also became a space of discussion of grief, of anger, of what some young people wanted to do in response to his death. Young people process and deal with things very differently to adults. You know, lots of those young people were 17, 18, 19 at the time.
But what the boys didn't know was that the messages in this group chat would later be used as evidence in court against them.
It allowed the net to be widened because then, well, if you were in a chat with each other, you're gang members.
The boys were accused of plotting revenge attacks for John's death. Some were charged with conspiracy to murder, and others with conspiracy to cause grievous bodily harm. Who they were plotting against, however, remains unclear. Throughout trial, no victim was ever identified.
When people read about it, because it's conspiracy to murder, conspiracy to cause, GBH, they think that someone was killed. No one was killed in this case, so it was a victimless trial.
Nevertheless, the boys were convicted and collectively received 131 years in prison.
Their grief was completely kind of co-opted and constructed as something that it wasn't.
We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Marnie Duke, and this is The Overturn. Today I'm heading up north to find out more about the case of the Manchester 10.
My name's Roxy Ligan. I'm the director of a youth organisation in Manchester called Kids of Colour. It's an anti-racist youth work organisation that's kind of interested in fighting for racial justice for young people of colour in Greater Manchester.
And how did you first hear about this case?
So I first heard about this case, and this is often how we hear about a lot of cases or a lot of the advocacy work that we're involved in, is that young people that we're connected to tend to come to us for support. So a young boy called Addy came to us after having been arrested at the very, very start of the journey of this case, just looking for some legal support. And then everything went from there. Addy was 17, a young person who had just experienced the loss of his friend, someone he was really close to.
Addy had known John since they were kids through family connections in the church and was devastated to hear about his murder. Out of the 10 boys convicted, he's often singled out by the press because of how well he was doing in school and his work in the community.
He was pretty exceptional for a young person. He had been head boy. He'd gone down to Parliament to talk about things. He had written a book about his local area, a local youth organisation. So there are lots of reasons that Addie's exceptionalism is often referenced. But I think for us as an organisation, we frequently want to remind people that young people shouldn't have to be exceptional to kind of avoid being imprisoned in these kind of cases. So John died on November 5th, 2020. And what became really important and significant in those days after were things like a Telegram chat that emerged on November 8th. It was created by one of the boys as a place to memorialise John and to talk about how they would remember him. But it also became a space of discussion of grief, of anger, of what some young people wanted to do in response to his death. And what I always reflect on here is that it was a space of very understandable grief and anger, not just for any of us, but especially for young people who process and deal with things very differently to adults. You know, lots of those young people were 17, 18, 19 at the time. John was obviously the friend of some of the boys in this case. I mean, they knew him to kind of differing degrees. Some of them would call him as close as family. Some of them would share that they know him kind of less intimately, but knew him in community as an aspiring kind of young rapper who was very good at what he was doing.
Each of the boys had varying degrees of involvement in the group chat. Addie, for example, who had known John since they were children, was active in it for just 20 minutes and sent 11 out of the 345 messages. One of these messages was a postcode of someone thought to have been involved in John's murder.
He shared a postcode in that chat, but the postcode, nothing ever went on to happen there. And I think that that's really important to understand, that this is a boy who was convicted of conspiracy to cause GBH because of a few messages in a chat that led to no harm, no incidences taking place, and that were an understandable thing that I think after someone harmed someone I loved, we'd be saying, where are they? How do we get some revenge? And those are the kind of motions you go through when experiencing grief.
Though no one named in the Telegram chat was ever hurt, one of the boys who had created the chat did go on to be involved in what the prosecution would call revenge attacks. A few days after John's death, two of the boys were involved in a non-violent chase at their college. 6 days later, one of those boys used a knife against another young person while a third boy was present. So there was violence, but only two of the boys in the case were present, and only one actually harmed someone. He was arrested and his phone seized for evidence.
What we're seeing time and time again now, not just in this case, but that, of course, young people's phones are taken at arrest. They are scoured through for information. They are looked through often by police officers who now have these labels of gang experts or kind of language experts in youth culture, scoured through to look for so-called evidence of perhaps the harms they've committed, but also who they're talking to, who their associations are, who their friends are, the people they're in contact with, you know.
Roxy says the discovery of the group chat allowed police to widen the net, that they used it as evidence to prove that all the boys involved were part of a violent gang.
I guess it becomes just a web via one boy's phone almost. So at that point, you don't really need every young person's phone because our lives are just there. The footprint is there, who we connect with, who we talk to, who we spend time with, who we allegedly don't like, who allegedly are opposing gang members. You know, all of those things are there in the footprint. It feels very much on our end more of a constructing crime than identifying it on phones. And it feels very much that that is exactly what happened here.
10 boys were arrested, some on charges of conspiracy to commit murder and others conspiracy to cause grievous bodily harm.
That chat on November 8th became evidence of the conspiracy in action. because these were boys that were prosecuted for conspiracy to murder and conspiracy to cause grievous bodily harm. And with conspiracy charges, you don't need to prove violence. You just need to prove that there was kind of an agreement to cause violence. A lot of them grew up within kind of the M40 postcode.
M40 is a postcode in Moston, the suburb just north of Manchester where the boys grew up. It's also the name of a drill music collective which some of them belonged to. The prosecution argued that this music collective was a gang.
It's quite a significant reality to this case because John was part of a music group called M40. And that kind of quite quickly in the prosecution's narrative became the key piece of information. Is M40 a music group or is M40 a gang? And it was their job to convince the jury that actually M40 was a gang. What happens in these cases, whether joint enterprise or conspiracy style cases, is that when it is black boys in the dock, the gang narrative is much more likely to be applied to them than if it was their white peers. And I think what's important with that is that the jury doesn't have to decide whether they're a gang or not. That's not the question being put to them, but that is really the narrative being pushed to them over and over and over again, drawing upon so many racist stereotypes within society and racist narratives until they're so convinced that they are a gang that the charges stick, really. And that was clear from the opening statements about this being a case of murder and revenge and the M40 gang. And as I said before, it was very useful that the M40 music group was a reality. It allowed them to, from the first weeks of trial, blast M40 music group tracks into the courtroom, to look at lyrics for weeks, you know, all of these things, to point to things like clothing and colours and associate them as kind of marks of gang culture and association and attachment. And the gang narrative was so important because it allowed the net to be widened, because then, well, if you were in a chat with each other, you're gang members. If you enjoyed the music, you're gang members. If you were friends with John, who was quite quickly constructed as the gang leader, which he can't defend because he's not here, then you were a gang member. In terms of the evidence, there are these kind of snapshots of young people's lives that are then drawn upon to construct gang membership. And
one example of this, in Addie's case, was a 9-second Snapchat video found on his phone showing a boy wearing a blue bandana with drill music playing in the background.
That blue bandana was a continual part of the narrative because the prosecution alleged that the M40 gang, their colour was blue. So it was simple as that, really, that he was in a video over 7 seconds with a blue bandana and therefore he's a gang member.
Another piece of evidence used was a picture of Addy holding a wad of cash to his ear.
And as is the racism towards black boys, apparently they can't have money without having some kind of criminal life that funds it. Addy at the time worked at this place in his local area called Spice Cabin. Everyone knew that. But yeah, he had a job. And you know, even if he didn't have a job, parents can give money, all these different things, right? But what that said to the prosecution was that he was a gang member. And because I think some of the others were doing it as well, but that became a big part of the appeal narrative, that there was this trend going on at the time. It was called the money phone trend that young people were doing on social media because celebrities were doing it. But all of that narrative, all of that kind of external understanding of what young people are doing never made it into the courtroom. You have police officers going through phones and through messages that young people have sent, and they do this so-called analysis that tells us what certain words mean and what gang speak is. And so much of it is just normal youth culture, normal young ways of speaking, normal digital ways of speaking for young people. It can be really, really despairing because you have this really strong narrative about black boys, black culture, young people coming from the prosecution that is completely supported outside of the courtroom by media. The general public understanding from, God, decades of racist media about black boys as collectives is that they are engaged in knife violence, in gang culture, and make horrific drill music. So that's the understanding people are often coming to the courtroom with, really reinforced by the prosecution, really manipulated and drawn upon by the prosecution. And I think it's important to say that in this trial, you had a number of boys that the prosecution were really able to make the narrative stick to. And then there were boys that didn't really fit to that narrative. For example, Addy, head boy, you know, all of these things. So towards the end of the trial, I think even the prosecution started to recognize that difference. They then started to kind of say that John was leading a double life. And his life was his gang membership with his drill group, and then his kind of nice life at church with the others who were lower down the defendant list, to still try and draw this net together. And what you kind of then saw in the outcome of this case, and this kind of exposes that you can really never win, even if you are kind of exceptional, that those exceptionalism type politics are just not what we need to be fighting on at all, is that four boys were convicted of conspiracy to murder, and six were convicted of conspiracy to cause grievous bodily harm. The fourth boy who was convicted of conspiracy to murder, he wasn't on any CCTV, so he got 20 years. The first three boys got 21 years. The six who were convicted of grievous bodily harm, most of them, kind of their evidence being telegram messages and some other things, were given 8 years. So collectively, they got 131 years in prison. But what's important about this case is that there was no victim. When people read about it, because it's conspiracy to murder, conspiracy to cause, GBH, they think that someone was killed. No one was killed in this case. So it was a victimless trial.
What were your next steps then? How did the campaign gain momentum?
So very early on, I was tweeting each day and letting people know what was going on in that courtroom. But it really gained momentum through those tweets, really. And that's not what I anticipated. It just felt like a necessary part of bearing witness and sharing what was happening in there. But of course, those kind of grew and gained a lot of attention. So then it was quite huge when the conviction came through, and at sentencing, you know, there were already journalists there at that point. We'd already gathered a lot of community support in different ways. So ahead of sentencing, we'd ask community members to complete a kind of survey on what they would offer if we were allowed to hold the boys in community instead on suspended sentences instead of in prison. And over 500 people contributed to that survey, offering all of these beautiful things that would have just been such an excellent alternative to prison. They were things like volunteering opportunities, jobs, mental health support, lifts to places to help them out, financial support, access to education, all of these things that would have made incredible differences to young people's lives. What's hard about a legal battle when you're a community organiser, when you're situated in more radical politics or ideas of what you want communities to be like, is that the legal battle, while the only real solution at the time to getting them out of prison, also really reduces you to legal arguments. And, you know, we want to scream about the way the gang narrative is applied, how racist it is, how the boys should have been able to say what they say anyway, and just be supported, you know, all of these things. But it has to come down to ways you can kind of either catch out or address errors of the trial with the previous legal teams, with the prosecution, with the judge, whatever. And that becomes quite narrow. I mean, it's still incredible work for those who do that work and who understand the law so deeply that they can find loopholes, find error, find all of these things. But they're not the arguments that are gonna shift this happening in community. And they're not the arguments that get to the very core of how racist policing is and how racist the criminal injustice system is and all of these things.
And those arguments didn't win when it came to the appeal.
What won for Addy was the fact that the person who really was in the video came to the Court of Appeal.
Roxy's referring to that 9-second video of a boy in a blue bandana found on Addie's phone and used against him to prove evidence of his gang membership. It turns out that the boy in the video wasn't even Addie.
So it was really just down to the fact that his previous team didn't do this work to get this video thrown out. And if that hadn't been a point of appeal, he'd still be in there.
Addie was acquitted. He was released from prison and had his conviction overturned. It was a huge win for the Manchester 10. But the other boys' appeals weren't so successful.
Two of the boys' sentences were reduced, and then the others who had put in for appeal didn't get anything. And it was just so heartbreaking, because especially for the boys on the really long sentences, but also just for dynamics, because we'd done this as a group, as a community the whole way. The families were together the whole way, which isn't always the case, these conspiracy trials, because ultimately there are fractures across groups of families, because in many instances someone is harmed and then some people feel that the others are there because that person harmed and it's not their fault. I feel that it's the way the state prosecutes it and they're to blame, but you can understand where those fractures come from. But these families had really stuck together this whole time. What was difficult was experiencing one family who was completely elated on the way to go and get their son, and then others who had sentencing appeals, so sentence reductions, which should have meant they were out, but only brought forward immigration issues, because we know that if you get over a 12-month sentence, you could be liable for deportation, depending on your immigration status. And so this shortened their sentence, which made those issues come further forward. So those boys were moved straight to immigration detention centres. And then, of course, the boys who got absolutely nothing and who had had a lot of hope, because there were those small wins, right? Like, we had got to the Court of Appeal. We'd had grounds given permission. I think it was like a lot of hope suddenly removed from you, which was really difficult. But also, people don't get acquitted. Young black boys don't get acquitted. So there was this huge win for Addy, but if we're to reflect on that more deeply, it's not like he's just free now. You know, he's not got any compensation. He's got many other difficulties as a result of spending 3 years in prison.
What would you say is the biggest toll on them and their families?
That is a sudden theft from your family life that feels like death. It essentially feels like kidnapping in my mind, like they've suddenly been taken away and now all of their agency is with the state and the prison, and you can't speak to them when you want to. To see them, you have to go through a really dehumanizing process of entering the prison, being watched, if you even get in. When you get there, there might be a number of reasons they reject your visit or just find more ways to dehumanize you or restrict your access to your child. I think it's just like this constant feeling of being held in this like lost place where you can't move forward at all until that person is free or back with you. We have so many ways that we can start to kind of undo cycles of violence in our communities. If after John died, there were real infrastructures immediately offered in community, you know, there was a wealth of youth workers, support workers, counsellors that could have reached out across the board to young people in Mostyn and offered support. People who are trained and expert in conflict resolution, who deal with the difficult stuff, the real dynamics that do exist in communities. None of us are saying they don't exist, but that there are better solutions for them. There are all of these solutions that could have been put in place earlier if police had seen that chat and said, right, we need to offer these young people support. But that's not what the police exist for. They exist to punish. So the failings in this case go back to after John died, but generally go back to the complete failure of this country to care for children, invest in their lives, and not just invest in violence and neglect of largely working class and racialized communities. And I've watched a lot of these trials now, and I just wonder where the fight is for these children and young people, and if it wasn't just such a game of negotiation between prosecution, defense, judge, you know, all of these things. It really is, as many people often refer to it, like a theatre in there, that is really not interested in truth or accountability or how we get to the bottom of things to make things better, but just interested in how we prosecute. So the failings are just really societal, and as a result, it's difficult to know where to start.
In the case of the Manchester 10, no one was murdered, but a collective 131 years in prison were handed down. Some boys merely sent texts the day after their friend was killed. The case demonstrates how powerful a prosecution tool conspiracy is, in that it allows prosecutors to use evidence that in other situations wouldn't necessarily be admissible. Evidence such as the messages sent in a group chat, or a 9-second video of a boy wearing a blue bandana. The boys' friendships and shared interests were used as evidence of gang membership, with lyrics and videos found on their phone presented to a mainly white jury as evidence of violent intent. While individually these may not have been compelling pieces of evidence, pieced together they formed a gang narrative that creates common intention between defendants. In January 2025, Ademola Adedeji had his conviction overturned because of a technicality. But for now, the rest of the boys remain in jail, hoping for a similar fate. This podcast is a production of the Future Justice Project. In the next episode, I speak to a former police officer who says that he was fit up by colleagues.
You're probably going to be putting me in a bag by end of day. You're going to kill me.
A Greater Manchester Police spokesperson said, "Cases of this nature are always tragic, particularly for victims of violence and the devastating consequences it can have on them. Our focus is getting justice for them. They are often complex and painstaking investigations, where we work with the CPS to prosecute suspects based on all the evidence available. Our priority is continuing to work with communities and partners to prevent this violence from happening in the first place. This preventative work, alongside our proactive approach, meant there were 1,600 fewer victims of violence in the past year."